they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers
and Kevin Zeese.
And Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to us on Apple, SoundCloud, MixCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find us at popularresistance.org. And while you're there, check out our store. You'll find Clearing the Fog gear like t-shirts, bumper stickers, tote bags, and water bottles.
And while you're there, also sign up for our daily news digest. We cover the movement around the world and throughout the country. Updates every day. You can sign up for a daily news digest and a weekly news summary that goes in-depth into key issues.
So this week we interviewed Chris Hedges about the liberal class, right wing, rising up.
Yeah, where we are. I mean, we spoke to Chris almost a year ago, and we were on, he says, a rebellion is coming, and asked, are we ready? The still question is out. The rebellion is here. Are we ready? Meaning, is the left ready to move the agenda in its direction?
And Chris really draws on decades of experience as a war correspondent, where he was in countries in Latin America, the Middle East, he was in the former Yugoslavia, and really saw, you know, firsthand and covered as these nations were going or were in turmoil. And so he draws parallels between those experiences and what's happening in the United States. So stick around for that interview. But before we get to that, let's talk about some things that are in the news. We'll begin with a COVID-19 update. We are now approaching or are around 6.2 million documented cases of COVID-19 in the United States, and we're approaching 190,000 deaths.
And we still don't have the basics in place. There's inadequate tracing. There's inadequate efforts to keep people segregated when they become infected. All the basics are not in place. The healthcare system's not up to par. I don't see this problem ending.
Yeah, and we're now seeing what's happening with the reopening of schools. A group of teachers, you know, started keeping the data, tracking the data on new cases in schools as they reopened with the face-to-face classes.
Doing the job the government should be doing.
Right, and now the National Education Association, or NEA, has taken over that function to host it on their website. And so they've identified, at the last available numbers, 2,500 infections in over 44 states.
And if we had a full accounting, those numbers would be higher. These are individuals and private organizations doing the work that should be done systematically by the government at all levels. Instead, you're seeing across the country schools that don't want to tell us about the virus. And so we're underestimating it, and it's making the same mistake that was made in the Midwest, where economies reopened without adequate controls and became super spreaders.
And actually, some schools are actively, you know, telling staff that you can't report to the public if you test positive.
What's the rationale for that? The only rationale is to hide the truth. Hiding the truth in a pandemic is the opposite of what government should be doing. People should be told, we have a virus in the school, keep your child at home.
Keep them away from people in your family who may be immune compromised or have serious health problems. Right, yeah, you need this information during a pandemic.
People so hiding, it's the irresponsible act.
Exactly. Also, teachers are having to form their own safety committees to make sure that their schools are, you know, safe and that they can protect themselves. We do know that there are increasing numbers of cases in children, a 21% increase during August. And of the children who are hospitalized, about one out of three of them end up in the intensive care unit. That's a similar rate to what we see with adults.
So much for the myth that children don't get the virus and don't get ill from the virus.
Right. And then another scary thing is that the Trump administration has made teachers something that they're essential for national security.
Essential workers, yes.
It's basically a way that they can force them back to work.
The result of that's going to be strikes.
Right, and we're also already seeing teachers organizing those. Also, campuses, universities are having difficulties as well. As they reopen, there are outbreaks happening across the country, schools having to shut back down again and go to online classes. SUNY Oneonta, the State University of New York system, one school had to go online in just a matter of 2 weeks of being open. University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa has over 1,000 cases. The University of Iowa reported 500 new cases, but this is happening across the country.
And those cases will result in hospitalizations, ICU admittances, and deaths.
Right. And once you start getting cases, as we need to remind people always, they grow exponentially as, you know, one person infects multiple people and those people infect multiple people. So, you know, they were saying early on that once you have one or two people testing positive, you know that it's in your community more widely than that. Remember, we're only catching, they estimate, about 10% of the people who are actually infected. Now, President Trump has chosen another person to join his COVID-19 team, this guy, Dr. Scott Atlas, who seems to have been chosen not because he has any expertise, but because he parrots the things that Trump wants to say. He's kind of giving cover for Trump. And it was leaked this week that they're having discussions in the White House about using a herd immunity approach.
He comes from a right-wing think tank, the Hoover Institution. He's a political choice, not a choice because of his professional abilities. He came out and said something favorable about herd immunity. And then the Washington Post reported on it, and he backtracked from that. But, you know, basically what we're seeing, because of the incompetence of U.S. government at every level, from Board of Education up to the president, mayors and governors included.
And CDC as well.
We're seeing a failed state. And that failure is because they are unequipped with an inadequate healthcare system, inadequate healthcare coverage, just don't have the ability to handle this. We're putting in place a herd immunity approach without intending to do so. By opening schools, especially colleges, and we are creating super spreader events. And the president shows he doesn't even care about that because he had the Republican National Convention at the White House. No one is wearing masks. It was like there was no such thing as a pandemic. It was just an absurdity. The wrong message to the country at a time when this pandemic is going to be escalating.
And another facet of our healthcare system that's really problematic is the way that we tie healthcare to employment. And so the Economic Policy Institute found that in March and April of this year, as people were losing their jobs, 3 million workers each month lost their health insurance as well. And that means, if you think about the fact that many people, you know, employment insurance covers their whole family, that it's more than 3 million people.
So 3 million people for a whole family, that's 12 million people.
It could be. Yeah.
Could be up to 12 million people. This is why we need improved Medicare for all. And yet, the Democratic Party convention did not mention Medicare for all. Bernie Sanders did not mention Medicare for all. AOC did not mention Medicare for all. It was not allowed to be said, despite the evidence at this stage at the highest it could be, showing that we need it as a government policy.
And most people want it.
Healthcare for everybody through a public program. And it's a majority support system, and yet it's not allowed to be talked about in the Biden campaign. Absurd.
Well, what would we expect from the corporate parties? They serve the corporations, not the people. And then another thing that the United States did around COVID-19, so Russia developed the first COVID-19 vaccine. It's in the testing phases right now. So what does the U.S. do? We slap sanctions on the Russian institutions that are developing the vaccine under this false claim that they are engaged in biological and chemical weapons. Same thing, we put new sanctions on Chinese institutions as well recently.
The United States has become an economic sanction abuser in a very serious way. And the country that will be most hurt by it will be the United States. The United States is going to be cut out of trade deals. The world's going to find ways to work around U.S. financial institutions. The dollar is no longer going to be the money that's used for trade. And that's going to hurt the United States more than any other country.
Right. Well, it's already happening. You know, most of the world's GDP, the global GDP, is coming from Eurasia, 55%. And there's now that new internal train line going from China all the way, you know, through Europe, and it's expanding. And so more and more Europe is trading with China. I think now Europe is trading 2 times more with China than it is with the United States.
That's going to be something that grows as the Belt and Road Initiative takes effect. They're even talking about developing a currency for the Belt and Road Initiative. This will cut the U.S. out of the biggest markets, Asia, through Africa, through Russia, Middle East, and into Europe. If the U.S. is not part of that, the U.S. is going to be left out of and have a shrinking economy.
And they're also turning to inland trade as opposed to using ships, because the United States is threatening, you know, so many of the coasts of countries like China, like Iran, threatening and could potentially, you know, squeeze off trade by that route. So
The U.S. has been stealing oil, claiming it violates the sanctions. I mean, so the U.S. has become a pirate on the seas. And so that's why Europe and Asia, connecting through the Belt and Road Initiative, is going to focus on land-based trade.
Right. And to your point about the U.S. dollar, you know, because of the sanctions, many countries are finding alternative ways to do trade, not using dollars. And Russia and China, two very large economies, have now used to do 90% of their trade in U.S. dollars. They're now down to 50% of trade in U.S. dollars and starting to use more euros.
So this trend is already happening. And the United States, because of the mismanagement of the economic collapse, is going to be going into a depression that's going to probably last several years. So as we get more economically weak, and Europe and Asia, Russia and Middle East are all trading with each other, we'll be cut out of more and more international finance, international trade, and we'll become weaker. The combination of a depression combined with these trends away from the U.S. dollar is going to have a big impact on the United States, and it's being made much worse by the abuse of sanctions we began under Obama and escalated dramatically under Trump, who's treated sanctions like it's giving out candy. It's going to really impact our economy in the long run in devastating ways.
It's also a huge opportunity. You know, if you had somebody in power that actually cared about the welfare of the people in the United States, we could do the same thing that Russia and China are doing, which their plan right now is to become more self-sufficient and only trade in the things they really need to trade. And so, you know, we have a real deficit of manufacturing in the United States. And we have people who are unemployed. A smart government would start investing in building up manufacturing, creating good jobs, creating the clean energy that we need, the products that we need, the healthcare products that we need to protect ourselves during the pandemic. There's doing the work of switching to, you know, electric rail system throughout the United States, building up our public transportation. There's so many things that we could be doing.
And doing it all as part of a Green New Deal. So it has some kind of strategy to putting in place a clean energy economy with efficient housing, efficient industry, efficient transportation. And you could talk about just like the Belt and Road Initiative for China to Europe. How about an initiative, economic initiative from Toronto to Brazil, you know, where you could connect the northern and southern hemisphere?
Last week, there was mass layoffs occurring. People are concerned that these temporary job losses from the pandemic are now becoming permanent job losses. MGM, the motion pictures, laid off 18,000 people. Bed Bath & Beyond, almost 3,000. Coca-Cola and airlines are laying off thousands, and many more companies as well.
And Congress is on vacation. That's what I meant when I said that they're mishandling the economic collapse. This recession is going to become a depression. It's going to have a long-term impact.
Let's talk about the protests that have been going on around the country. Those continue. Particularly, people are aware of what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where the Black Lives Matter protests over the police shooting of Jacob Blake, you know, resulted in a lot of protests in that town. And then a 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse went to Kenosha as part of a right-wing militia and ended up shooting and killing Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum. Anthony Huber was 26, Rosenbaum was 36, and also wounding Gage Grosskreutz, a 26-year-old medic.
And now Trump is going to Kenosha. The governor of Wisconsin and local politicians are urging him to stay away because he'll escalate the conflict. They're trying to calm things down, afraid he's going to escalate and cause more division. Trump is essentially the unofficial commander of these right-wing militias. He could say, stay home. He could say, keep your guns away from the protests. You know, people go out and protest. If you're conservative and oppose the idea of ending racial police killings, if you support racial police killings and you want to go and protest that, go do it, but don't bring a weapon. Trump can be, he is the unofficial commander. And so his failure to say anything and now going to the site, this could be an escalation of even more violence.
Yeah. And then, you know, we saw that over the weekend in Portland where a car caravan, was mostly pickup trucks of Trump supporters, drove through downtown Portland using pepper spray and paint guns to shoot at anti-police violence protesters who were out there. Ended up in one person who was affiliated with the right-wing group Patriot Prayer who was killed in that. They went right there to instigate violent.
Well, this is, and I think over the next 2 months, this is going to get worse. This campaign, the Republicans wanted to be out law and order. So creating disorder as an excuse for now we need law and order is consistent with their political goals. And so I expect this is going to escalate. Biden is incompetent. Seems like he has come out and said he's against all violence. Okay, what's he doing? And what are the Democrats doing? So it's got this bad momentum that's leading to a much greater conflict up to the election. I'm afraid even after the election, no matter how it turns out, the seeds are being planted for a very violent period in the United States.
Last week on this show, we talked about a new report out by the Alliance for Global Justice that documents that repression is on the rise in the United States. More arrests, more detentions, more violence. A couple of other studies that are interesting is a new Brennan Center report. It's called Hidden in Plain Sight, Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. And it shows how these law enforcement institutions are connected with the right-wing militias. And that's what we see in practice in these cities where there's violence.
Well, in Kenosha, we saw the police saying to the right-wing militias, we're glad you're here, and we'll send the protesters, you take care of them.
And giving them water.
And giving them water and essentially being friends with them. And we've seen pictures around the country of the police and the militias having pictures taken together. But this report, this Brennan report, is a very detailed report. It documents the fact that there is connection between police and these militias in 40 states. And it documents that the government knows this. The government is aware of this, and there's no response. The Department of Justice is not investigating this. There's no focus on police departments that have been shown to be infiltrated with these militia groups and are allied with these militia groups. Nothing's being done to stop this, even though the Department of Homeland Security says that right-wing militias are the greatest threat of terrorism in the United States. So we're being told this is the threat, and nothing's being done.
And we're seeing the police actively working with these right-wing militias and, you know, using violence. But what I found interesting is that in some police departments that tried to deal with police that they knew were overtly racist, they ended up losing because they countersued and said this is a violation of our First Amendment rights. So I think it makes it hard for police departments to take that kind of action.
Well, they have no choice but to take that kind of action, or they should be disbanded.
Right.
It might be that this is not a reformable situation.
Yeah.
And it's a big challenge because there are so many guns in the United States,
mm-hmm.
In civilian hands, mm-hmm. people who are not really well enough trained to handle the situations. Some people have their own political agendas or their own racism or their own other issues. It's a very hard to control situation the United States has created. What this shows, this whole discussion from the pandemic to policing, what we see is a failed state. A country that can't control its police, can't provide basic health care, can't run an effective election. This is a failed state, and is becoming more and more obvious to not just people in the United States, but around the world.
And in that Brennan Center report, they talk about the fact that the reforms that are being talked about won't change the fact that these police, you know, institutions are affiliated actively with these right-wing militias. And it reminds me of what we saw when we were protecting the Venezuelan embassy last year, when people who were against the coup, you know, anti-war peace activists, were outside of the embassy protesting the United States trying to conduct a coup in Venezuela. These right-wing, we believe affiliated with probably the State Department or somebody, organized because they had a lot of money and a lot of equipment and it all matched. And they would attack or verbally abuse or put megaphones right in someone's ear, shining lasers in people's lights, all of these that are not legal. And the police would be there and watching them and would refuse to do anything about it. And when they would attack or assault one of the peace activists, the police would say, oh, well, if you want us to arrest them, we're going to arrest you too.
Or sometimes they would just only arrest the peace activists.
Right.
And when they broke and entered into the embassy and were removed, they were not arrested for breaking and entering.
No, they were basically clapped on the back and, hey, are you okay? Do you need anything?
Let's do selfies together.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it was obviously, so this connection, that was a very coordinated response to our protection of the embassy to bring these right-wing Latin Americans up, these Cuban activists, these Venezuelan activists,
Nicaraguan,
all right-wingers who left their countries because they moved to the left, because they became more progressive.
Because their countries moved to the left.
That's right. So yeah. They came up and they are now working with the State Department to support coups in these governments. And that meant attacking us at the embassy.
So this is a reality that we have to confront when we're talking about how to change policing in our communities, how to really create public safety. I just want to highlight quickly another report. CAR, the Center for the Analysis of Radical Right, has a report out. We published this on Popular Resistance called Faces of the Radical Right. It looks at it globally, not just in the United States, so people can get a sense of how these radical right institutions are entering into media and politics and cloaking themselves in this populist language to appeal to people that are disaffected.
It's not only a nationwide problem, but a global problem, but that it's in response to also a rising of the left.
Mm-hmm.
There's also people rising up organizing for workers' rights, for end to racism, for end to imperialism, end to war. People are organizing in those ways as well. So this is a conflict. And unfortunately, conflict is how change happens. And we have to get better prepared for those who want to see a progressive future where human rights are respected and healthcare is provided and wars are not the answer. We've got to organize better in order to push our agenda.
Well, it's only going to happen if people are organized and make it happen. Otherwise, the forces are aligned. I think the resources are on the side of favoring the corporate polluters and the corporate exploiters and that right-wing agenda. But some people are taking concrete action to create public safety. A group of Black families bought a large parcel of land and are creating their own city. They call it Freedom, and it's going to be a Black-run city. They're using cooperative economics on it to create safety for themselves and their children. And what's interesting is this mirrors what happened during Reconstruction after the Civil War, when there was a rise of Black cities across the country that used cooperatives.
Cooperatives have been part of U.S. history from our founding. The Pilgrims in Cairo could not have survived if they didn't take a cooperative approach, and even a cooperative approach with the indigenous initially. But cooperatives have been part of U.S. history throughout. This is another phase of it. When times get tough, people band together in mutual aid and cooperation, working for common ends.
Yeah, pooling their resources. I want to highlight a struggle that's going on in Maryland. We had Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo on this show a few months ago to talk about a African cemetery that the city is bulldozing and building a storage, or allowing a storage center to be built there, desecrating the cemetery that is there. It's the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, if people want to check that out. Well, they're out there now protesting every week. The company is bringing in dump trucks, digging up the dirt, hauling it away to a private landfill.
Essentially destroying the evidence.
They saw what looks like a gravestone very clearly. They've seen other funerary artifacts. They've seen what looks like part of a coffin. And they're saying, stop, we need to check this out. We want our own Black archaeologists to come in. They're not being allowed to do that. So now they're appealing. They wrote a letter to the county executive to get him, because he insinuated that he might shut it down if
Mark Elrich is a Democrat known as kind of an anti-developer Democrat, kind of on the progressive left of the Democratic Party. But so far, he has not done what's needed to be done to stop this destruction of this African cemetery. And the evidence is starting to mount up now that there is actually artifacts there.
And
from
bodies, remains.
From funerals, the old cemetery. So the evidence is mounting. And they're really trying to put the pressure on this week to make him take action to stop what's going on. Because every truck that leaves there, and there's been dozens of trucks.
Hundreds, they think.
Every day.
Yeah.
Dozens of trucks a day. So hundreds of trucks have gone, and they're essentially taking the evidence.
Destroying the evidence.
Destroying the evidence and bringing it to dump sites on private property where no one can examine them. And so this is an evidence destruction of a African history, and it's an important history. If people didn't hear that interview we did with Marsha Coleman Adebayo, you go back and listen to it. You can find it on popularresistance.org. Check out the podcast page and go back to that interview. It's a very powerful interview.
It is just the history that they've uncovered in this struggle, which has been going on for years now. And just the whole, it's such a blatant example of white supremacy and systemic racism that it's an educational opportunity for people to really understand what's going on.
Because it ended up, as they got into it, it's not just about a cemetery.
Right.
It's about the entire African history in the United States from before the country was founded, tobacco plantations, to when the slavery was no longer allowed to be imported from Africa and people started to breed slaves. They were breeding plantations at these sites. Then it became an African town that was forced out by white suburban development. It's a whole history of abuse of African people. So there should be a museum at this site about this history, because it's one we have to face up to.
Well, that's what they want to see. They've already done one museum exhibit, and they're working on another museum exhibit, that if they had a museum, they'd be able to put these exhibits in there. But right now they're just using other spaces to do that. So they're going to have a major action on September 4th at noon in Bethesda, Maryland. If anybody's in that area, check out Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition. Let's quickly talk about, we're switching to Latin America now. The president of Colombia has given his approval for U.S. troops to be operating in Colombia. Of course, they've been there for a while, but this goes against what the Congress of Colombia, some members of Congress are opposed to that. And Venezuela is reporting that they have intelligence that Colombian troops are preparing for some sort of aggression against Venezuela.
I just put up an article on Popular Resistance this morning about the right-wing political parties having a strategy to not participate in the elections and to go back to the streets with violence.
Political parties in Venezuela.
The right-wing political parties in Venezuela, mm-hmm. Going back to a violence approach because they cannot win democratically. They know they're going to lose the elections. The people support the Bolivarian process. Maduro's support has gotten stronger because of the U.S. attacks, because of Juan Guaido's, you know, fake attempt to seize the presidency. And the so people are on the side of the Bolivarian process. And so the right wing is going to stay away from the elections because they know they're going to lose and instead go to the streets and violence is going to escalate. And so the U.S. troops being there is part of that process.
Right. And this is would be similar to what they did in 2014 and 2017 with the Warimbas, the street blockades, where they just grabbed people that they thought were Chavista supporters. In those 2 years, or those years of those blockades, more than 100 Venezuelans were killed because of that.
With a very special focus on Afro-Venezuelans. There were lynchings of Afro-Venezuelans and burnings of Afro-Venezuelans. Mm-hmm. Very violent protests. And that's why these people can't win elections, because they show this violent side, this racist, violent side, and people, I don't want them in power. Can you imagine those people having the power of government? Yikes.
Well, they side with U.S. imperialism, and that was another thing that the majority, vast, overwhelming majority of people in Venezuela oppose U.S. imperialism. They don't want the U.S. to come back in and the corporations to steal their resources as they've done in the past when they had tremendous amounts of poverty. They've come a long way in meeting their basic needs for education, healthcare, housing, jobs, and they don't want to go back. So this is going to be a fight, unfortunately. We as people in the United States need to tell our government to stop. Hands off Venezuela, stop the sanctions that are killing Venezuelans.
Unfortunately, it's a bipartisan issue. Even AOC won't take a position on it. She says, I'll leave it to the leadership of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Even Sanders.
And Joe Biden has had terrible history on it. Of course, the Obama administration was the ones that first declared Venezuela to be a national security threat. How absurd. And that was the excuse to start to put sanctions in. And Trump is built on that. So this is a bipartisan problem. And so the people really have to stand up and say no to the economic war and the threat of military.
Let's remind our listeners that Julian Assange's extradition trial starts in September 7th. His partner, Stella Morris, and children were able to visit him recently for the first time in almost 6 months to see him in person. And she reports that physically he doesn't look like he's doing well, and that as this major trial is about to begin, he has not been able to meet face-to-face with his lawyers or get the materials that he needs to prepare for that trial.
This trial is a charade, and that's why they're keeping the media out of the courtroom. They don't want people to see what's really going on. This will be, whatever it turns out with this trial, which I expect will not be good for Assange because the judge has shown her bias, I expect we'll see an appeal. This will go on for years. Unfortunately, Julian Assange will probably be incarcerated during that time. I suspect the U.S. government very much would like to see him die in prison. That would remove this burden of this trial that might come up in the United States. So it's not a good scene. What they're doing to Julian Assange is just hard to stomach.
Yeah, and let's remind our listeners that if they're successful in this extradition or killing Assange, I mean, this just will have an even greater chilling effect on journalism around the world and journalists being willing to expose corruption, war crimes, you know, the things that the United States doesn't want to have exposed. It has, the U.S. has a global reach now to stifle dissent.
And we can see that already in the United States at these national uprising protests against police violence. We're seeing journalists targeted. Just last week, a court in Oregon, a federal court in Oregon, lifting the ban on arresting journalists and legal observers. I mean, so we're seeing a real disrespect for journalism at the local level up to the international level.
And let's quickly talk about Belarus, because we've been reporting on this over the last few weeks. Of course, there's an uprising there, and the United States invested a lot of money in Belarus to try to enhance that uprising and overthrow the government there in order to use Belarus as a NATO country to antagonize Russia. It looks like this effort has backfired, and instead, Belarus has tightened its alliance with Russia, finally formalizing this union state that they had agreed to years ago. And so even NATO and the Atlantic Council are saying that it didn't work.
They're still protesting, so it's not over yet, but so far it's backfiring, and it's a critically important important geographic area between Poland and Russia. Poland is where the U.S. is sending a lot of the troops from, our troops from Germany. And so that's becoming a major military stronghold for the United States. And so Belarus is right in the middle of that between Russia and Poland. So it's a very important geopolitical fight, as well as a domestic fight for the people of Belarus. The people of Belarus, of course, have real concerns about the government, but it's up to the people of Belarus to solve that problem. And we see what happens when the United States comes in. Ukraine had concerns about their government, too. But now the people of Ukraine are much poorer. The country's more in debt. It's not working as well. So people of Belarus need to solve this problem. The U.S. needs to stay out.
Well, that's all we have time for. Why don't we take a short musical break, and we'll come back with Chris Hedges.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers
and Kevin Zeese.
And now we turn to our guest, Chris Hedges. Chris is a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who reported for 2 decades as a war correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, and the former Yugoslavia. He's an author of a dozen books and the host of On Contact on RT America.
Thanks for joining us, Chris.
We had you on
last December, and the topic we talked about was the coming rebellion and whether the left was ready for it. And now we are in the midst of this national uprising and a rebellion is here. Is the left ready for it? How do you see the current situation?
Dangerous, because the left is not at all formed in any kind of a political sense. As heroic and admirable as these street protests are, I think they do have an understanding of the systemic problems of power. They're not being gaslighted by Muriel Brower, who the mayor of Washington, who paints 35-foot-high letters, Black Lives Matter, on a street near the White House. At the same time, she calls for a $45 million increase in the police budget and a $500 million new jail. Nor are they being gaslighted by cops who take the knee, or Nancy Pelosi wearing a kente scarf. They get it. On the other hand, the assault against the American left has been so pervasive for so long that I don't know that we have created, we have the Green Party, but I don't think we have created, certainly among, massive grassroots organizations, a political vision, an alternative. The vigilante violence, which has been on display in the streets of our cities, is going to get worse, whether Trump is defeated or not, because the issues that have alienated and enraged the white working class are about to get much, much worse, because the unemployment benefits have not been extended, the moratorium on foreclosures and evictions has been lifted. So we're talking about an estimated 40 million Americans losing their home. The pandemic is out of control. Estimates are saying 300,000 dead by December, 400,000 dead by January. The Democrats under Biden have made it clear that they will not respond with the kind of radical social and economic programs that are absolutely essential if the country is going to gain any kind of equilibrium. So you know, I'm extremely concerned. And I think that we, the left, who seek to promote an alternative vision, a socialist vision, an anti-imperialist, military vision, because of course so much of our resources, 53% of discretionary spending, go to the military to fund these endless wars, now almost two decades long. We've been effectively shut out, as Howie Hawkins and the Green Party has just been shut out, even by the left. So these are all very, very, ominous signs.
Yeah, and something that you've been warning people about for quite some time. You've written a lot about the liberal class, and I'm wondering if you can just describe for our listeners kind of, you know, every election cycle, we get into this lesser evil kind of voting situation. What role does the liberal class play in kind of maintaining the power structure and the status quo?
Well, this comes from Chomsky, and, you know, I wrote a book called Death of the Liberal Class that examines precisely this issue. But I told Noam I probably should have written him as a co-author, because so much of what I understand about how liberal elites work in a capitalist democracy comes from Noam. And as Chomsky points out, the role of the liberal class and the reason that it's traditionally tolerated in a capitalist democracy is because it posits itself as the moral arbiter of the society. It cloaks itself in that kind of mantle, and it uses it to shut out the radical left. So the example Noam Chomsky gives in Manufacturing Consent, the book he wrote with Ed Herman, is about the Vietnam War. You could have the old columnist Anthony Lewis for the New York Times criticize the war as a mistake or as misguided, but you could never criticize the motives or the virtues of the people who carried out the war. That's a classic example of how the liberal class works. Now, the liberal class in a capitalist society, what it does is it ameliorates. It acts as a kind of safety valve in the times of social stress. This is what Roosevelt did, although in a fairly radical way, during the New Deal. So it addresses the excesses of the system. I mean, for instance, like an indiscriminate lethal police violence, without speaking about the fact that the police, which to be frank is unfair to the police, along with the prison system, are the two primary forms of social control among populations that have been utterly dispossessed under neoliberal economics. They won't address that issue. They'll address shooting a man in front of his children seven times in the back, for example, or Breonna Taylor bursting into her apartment and killing her in her own apartment, that kind of stuff. And that gives them the ability to then ridicule, shut out those on the left who are offering a systemic critique of the system. What's interesting and I think very dangerous for the ruling elites is that, not understanding the role of the liberal class, they went after the liberal class itself, particularly under Clinton. And so what you created are these faux liberals. You created politicians like Barack Obama, like Bill Clinton, who speak in the traditional feel your pain language of liberalism, but assiduously serve corporate power and betray the working class. And that has created much of the political problem that we have, because the white working class, which at under the old Democratic Party system had a voice in labor. And it was, you know, they were junior partners in the capitalist system, the radical unions, the old CIA, and Wobblies had been wiped out in the name of anti-communism, but even they were pushed out. And so much of the anger that you see, the nativist violence, the neo-Confederate movement, the celebration of white supremacy, white mythology, comes from a working class, particularly white working class, that once had a place, however marginal. And so the liberal establishment has mutated and changed. And we saw it on display at the Democratic National Convention. It no longer stands for anything. There were two messages that were just repeatedly hammered home at the DNC, and one is we're not Trump, and the other is Joe Biden, Uncle Joe is such a nice man, which is ridiculous, especially when you look at Biden's policies. I teach in a prison, half of my students wouldn't be there, but for Joe Biden and Bill Clinton, the whole militarized police was his project, along with the wars in Iraq and everywhere else. So austerities called on numerous occasions for cuts to Social Security. He was a fervent segregationist. I mean, on and on and on. So we are in a tremendous crisis, because when your liberal society is rendered impotent, as it was, as I saw in the former Yugoslavia, we'll go back to Ebert and the end of the Weimar Republic, then they lose all credibility, and people turn on not just the false hypocrisy of liberalism, which is what liberalism has become, but on the supposedly purported values that liberalism upholds. And that's where we are.
Yeah, you know, when you talked about the current crisis issues, the mass unemployment, evictions, people, you know, losing their homes because of the economic collapse and the pandemic, I was thinking about the systemic problems being so much bigger and how it's going to get so much worse for the working class of all colors. You know, you look at the broad trends of trade, which has been going on since Bill Clinton and NAFTA. You look at the U.S. being cut out of trade deals around the world, the dollar no longer being dominant, the impact of climate crisis, which should have been dealt with as early, long ago as Clinton and Gore, and it still has not been dealt with. And look at the effects on California and Louisiana right now. But these are long-term big changes. We're going to see the U.S. economy in the next decade go through a tremendous downward shift. We're going to have this initial depression from the current collapse. Then that's going to be followed by the U.S. being shut out of a lot of international deals as the China, Russia, Germany trade route becomes a dominant political force. In the future, it's going to be much tougher. So how do you see the left having to organize? I mean, I see that we have a great foundation with the national uprising, with hundreds of wildcat strikes, people are taking action. But where do we need to go to really have the impact we need to have to create the transformations that are urgently needed?
Well, it has to be wedded to an alternative political vision. And it has to extend beyond defunding these militarized forces of occupation and what Malcolm X called our internal colonies. It has to be a wresting back of power from the corporate oligarchy. And in, you know, all militant movements, they start out small and beleaguered, but they hold fast to those moral imperatives. And the mass propaganda that saturates the American airwaves has done a very effective job of selling this very pernicious political idea that you vote based on hate. You vote against the person you hate. So if you're a Democrat, you vote against Trump. If you're a Republican, you vote against Biden or Clinton or Obama or whoever. But it's all based on hate. It's not based on policy. It's built around manufactured political personalities. It's anti-politics. It's not really politics at all. And I think that courtesy of a corporate-dominated media, these constant antagonisms, which are built around culture wars and which are never-ending, mask the fact that on all of the major issues, there is no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. You know, they all support the same trade deals. They all support wholesale government surveillance of the American public. They all support the endless wars and the disproportionate amount of money and resources that are handed to the military. They're all culpable in terms of mass incarceration, militarized police, austerity. So Gramsci wrote about this. I mean, the power of culture, of mass culture, is a very effective form of control. And those of us who, and you do this, and I do this, and Noam Chomsky, Cornel West, others do, who challenge that narrative and attempt to speak about the real configurations of power and how they work, have been really effectively blanked out. And the worse it's gotten, the more that, the harsher that kind of censorship has become. So when Matt Taibbi wrote his book on the media, Hate Inc., which is pretty good, he has on one side of the cover Sean Hannity and the other Rachel Maddow. And he's not wrong. They're both serving the same system.
Really good point.
Yeah. And the censorship is problematic because it is increasing. We're seeing it on Facebook and Twitter, you know, shutting down pages and accounts, and they have no accountability. But I want to get into something that you've written about, and in fact, you wrote a book about this in 2007, American Fascist, the Christian Right, and the War on America. And you've written about fascism, as you said, it's bipartisan, it's just presented differently by the different parties. But you've really kind of gone in depth to look at the rise of the Christian Right. Can you talk about that in terms of what you're seeing right now? And, you know, is this the vision that you warned about, is this starting to come true?
Yeah. So, you know, I come out of a religious tradition. My father was a minister. My mother actually also graduated from seminary, grew up in the church. I went to Harvard Divinity School myself. So, I'm attuned to the distortions of the Christian right, who I consider heretics. They have perverted the Christian gospel to fit with the worst elements of American imperialism and American capitalism. And they function as cults. I've been in these megachurches. I spent 2 years on that book. I sat through, you know, sessions with James Dobson and D. James Kennedy and all other people who run it. And they are white male cults. These are narcissists. They prey on the despair of the followers in this movement. The first chapter of my book is called Despair. I went into the reporting for this book with many of the prejudices coming out of the liberal or the left church. My father was very close to the Berrigans and the civil rights movement. Annie Warren, himself a veteran, combat veteran from World War II. But I heard these stories of, you know, tremendous economic dislocation, bankruptcies, evictions, struggles with substance abuse, domestic violence, sexual violence. And you'd have to be heartless not to feel for the very real suffering that these people went through. And they were targeted and preyed upon by con artists and demagogues who promised them magic Jesus. Magic Jesus would protect them. Magic Jesus would make them wealthy. But of course, you had to buy the prayer cloth and tithe and send, and the narcissists, almost always white male, who run these mega church and huge evangelical organizations, became incredibly wealthy, flying around in private jets and living in mansions. Very similar to Trump. People say, how can the, you know, the Christian right build an alliance with Trump? And I'll say, because there's no difference. They're exactly the same figure. Trump's sham university is no different from Joel Osteen's con. So the rise of this movement, and again, was benefited by a failure on the part of the liberal church to call them out for what they were, which was heretics. You don't need to spend 3 years at Harvard Divinity School, as I did, to figure out that Jesus didn't come to make us rich. Jesus didn't come to bless the dropping of iron fragmentation bombs on our enemies. Jesus didn't come to celebrate the white race, and in particular, white Americans, above other races. In fact, of course, Jesus wasn't white. The Romans were white. Jesus was a person of color. So, but saying, it was interesting that presenting this kind of critique, which was a decade ago, was very unpalatable to the very institutions that I was aligned with. So that when I was on book tour, my agent, and it was a New York Times bestseller, the book did well. And I was in Boston, and my agent called Harvard Divinity School, and they said, no, we don't want on this issue, because they are trying to build dialogue with a heretical movement, and they didn't like the fact that I was calling them out as heretics. So what I found about the Christian right is that it was all a patina, that it was all about power. And of course, they have tremendous funding from the Koch brothers and others, because if magic Jesus is going to take care of you, you don't need labor unions. The whole move towards sort of building the Christian society, and of course, you know, the figures, Betsy DeVos, Mike Pence, Pompeo, Carson, they all come out of the Christian right, and Trump, who has no ideology, has essentially filled his ideological void with the Christian right. And they are America's homegrown fascist movement. And I remember saying to the journalist Jeremy Scahill once that the only difference was that they don't actually have an armed wing. Most fascist movements have an armed wing. And he said, no, you're wrong. Eric Prince, Blackwater, Betsy DeVos's brother, they have the private militias. That is, and he, of course, Jeremy, who wrote the book, great book on Blackwater, was right. So as we see the rise of vigilante violence in our streets, we're seeing now the uptick, which, having covered the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times, I see so many frightening parallels between now what's happening and what happened then. That potentially could explode very quickly. And the Christian right will be at the center of it. So my fear with electing Biden is that this ensues a competent fascist, probably a Christian fascist. The root problem of where we are today stems from the Democratic Party's betrayal of the working class. Barack Obama was elected in 2008 on a mandate to respond to the corruption and the dislocation and NAFTA, the looting by Wall Street, and he sold everyone out. So I blame Obama and I blame the Democratic Party for creating the monstrosity of Trump. And with or without Trump, with Biden as president or Trump as president, this vigilante violence is going to increase. In fact, of course, if Biden is president, it'll probably even be worse.
And unfortunately, too often the police are alive with that, the vigilante violence that we saw in Kenosha, how friendly they were with the militias who showed up. You know, that you mentioned earlier that what's missing from the left is really pulling it all together into an ideology, an alternative political vision. And in the United States, we've been a two-party, deeply embedded two-party system for so long that it's very hard to get that alternative vision out through those two parties. They always have represented big business interests. They, from slavery to, you know, the Gilded Age, until now, they've always represented big business, the two parties have. So the role third parties play often in history is to present that alternative vision, to pull everything together and say, here's the systemic problem, here's the systemic solution, here's how we have to transform our economy and our politics in order to meet the needs. And so throughout history, third parties have done that, allying with the abolition movement, the working people's movements of unions and 8-hour workdays and ending child labor. The whole New Deal came out of the socialists and the populist parties, the progressive parties. But today we have a hard time getting the third party view out. I mean, Howie Hawkins is presenting that kind of systemic critique and an alternative vision, tying it all together into a political philosophy, but he's not being covered in the media. Even Democracy Now, probably the best progressive media out there, has not interviewed Howie Hawkins. It's just bizarre. So how do we get in this political system, how do we get that alternative vision out there with the traditional role third parties play in this very tightly controlled two-party system?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the cultural landscape has changed radically from what it was when Eugene V. Debs and the Socialist Party mounted a pretty, I think, as height got 6% of the vote. You don't have unions. And one of the important things about unions was not just protecting workers and workers' rights, but providing educational space. You had a decentralized media, hundreds of newspapers, Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist newspaper, had the fourth highest circulation in the country. You had a literacy. So if you read Emma Goldman's memoir, these sweatshop workers on the Lower East Side were working 12 hours a day and then going to anarchist meetings in Yiddish. So the digital landscape, the consolidation of media, the breakup of communal structures, combined with an assault on in the name of anti-communism, and of course many of the targets of the red hysteria weren't actually red, they were people with a social conscience. They were including Henry Wallace in 1948, who had been Roosevelt's vice president. So that ability to communicate, particularly on the grassroots, is gone. The labor halls in small towns don't exist anymore. I mean, Ralph Nader talks about this, and he's right. There isn't even a physical space. The public space, you know, what Cicero called the res publica, it's not there. You can't have it. I mean, I remember doing this book on the Christian right, and I'd go into these devastated Rust Belt towns in Ohio, and the only, but I mean, literally, you couldn't drive more than 15 miles up and down the street because of the potholes. There was plywood over the windows of the stores. And the only new beautiful building was the megachurch that was pulling in 30,000 a week in offerings. So the cultural, the social landscape in the United States has been so perverted. People have been atomized. They've been broken up from communities. The internet is not an effective way to transmit ideas. So I think all of these forces combined with, as you correctly point out, the overt censorship to keep most of the American public, you know, locked away from these ideas. And now we're seeing the algorithms, which I've been a victim of, from Facebook and Google and Twitter, to push critics such as myself even further to the margins, because since the capitalist class no longer really has a response, I mean, people have their ideology of neoliberalism has lost all of its credibility, critics are more dangerous because they don't really have an answer. So there are a series of convergent forces that have come together to serve corporate power and to keep people essentially locked away from the critiques and the systems of information that are vital for them to understand their own predicament, that it's not an individual or a personal predicament, but a social predicament.
You know, you wrote America the Farewell Tour and the breakdown of our society. We're now seeing the United States, you know, really becoming a failed state, power declining around the world. We're really entering or are in a very dark period, and now the rise of this kind of violence. You've seen this before in other countries that you've covered. What is your recommendation, you know, to people right now in terms of, you know, you've said before that or written before that, you know, people didn't see what was coming, you know, until it was right there. So what do you kind of see coming, and what do you think people should be prepared for, and how do they deal with it?
And what can we do to make this end well?
If that's possible.
Well, I don't think it's going to end well. I mean, my book, America the Farewell Tour, is out of Durkheim, and it's on his great work on suicide. And he asks, what is it that drives individuals and societies to commit acts of self-annihilation? And he ties it to the rupture of social bonds, work, a place in the community, a meritocracy, the ability to self-actualize yourself, to find dignity and worth within the society. When that's broken, then people engage in very self-destructive behaviors, and that the book focuses on the opioid crisis and gambling written out of the Trump Taj Mahal, white militias. I spent time with Proud Boys, Knights of the Old Right, Three Percenters, because as Durkheim writes, those who seek the annihilation of others are driven by desires for self-annihilation. Suicide, which is an epidemic among middle-aged white men for all of these reasons. And you know, I like you, remain deeply wedded to nonviolence as a form of protest. I have been very critical of Black Bloc and Antifa over this, because that plays into the hands of the state, and it marginalized those of us who are in the opposition. I think our best hope is to pull in huge numbers people into the streets. You know, it's brought the government down in Lebanon. Where that will go, I don't know, because they did that in October in 2019 as well, but massive sustained nonviolent civil disobedience to disrupt the system, in support of Extinction Rebellion for this, that is our only hope. On the other hand, I think we have to be very clear-eyed about the deep moral, physical, political, economic decay that is in front of us. We don't do ourselves any favor by engaging in false hope. That's in fact an enemy. I think we have to recognize, and we haven't spoken about the climate crisis in depth, but you know, there are very many bleak warning signs in front of us, and it is our duty to resist through nonviolence. At the same time, we can't be Pollyannish about what's happening around us.
Yeah, great points. I guess we'll have to close it there. people can, we publish Chris on Popular Resistance, on SharePost, you can read him. His On Contact is widely available, so you can keep up with Chris's thoughts on these. He's in the midst of a great book that he's working on that'll come out shortly. So lots of great ways to keep informed what Chris is doing. We really appreciate you being on again. Now that we're in the midst of this rebellion, we talked about a year ago about going into it. Now we're into it. And where it goes from here, well, that remains to be seen. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's all we have time for today. Let's go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want Because
The People Organized
Can Build the Kind of Future We Want.
Lift our brothers and our sisters. The people together can